here's the outline for the talk. I want to start with a few basics, especially for those of you who maybe have, that they sat in an astronomy lecture, just to give you an understanding of how we can do what we are doing. Then I want to give a little bit historic overview over galaxies. What are galaxies? How were they discovered? And while actually preparing the talk, it came back to me that talking about galaxy evolution, I could fill several lectures over several weeks. So I have to restrict myself, and I will touch on a few key questions we want to answer with our studies, and then going to present results from a few studies we did specifically here at Louisville. So let's start with the basics. I guess many of you asked themselves how we can go from looking at the sky, seeing all these beautiful stars there, like here on this image, it's Black Rock Desert in Nevada. How can we go from there to there, understanding how the universe has formed and evolved? Now, to answer that question, we first have to understand what types of experiments we can do as astronomers. And we are in an unlucky position compared to many of our other colleagues who can just simply step into their laboratories and start putting things together and manipulate their experiments in a way so they understand what's going on. We are pretty much limited to an observer side, so we only have light as our tool. However, light is a fascinating thing. It gives us information over a wide range of wavelengths or frequencies. From the shortest wavelengths with high energies, the gamma rays, all the way back to radio waves, which are of the size of buildings. And this is what we can use to disentangle all the information we want to have about how the universe formed, how it evolved, and how we humans came. Now, traditionally, most of our knowledge until recently was based on observing the sky in the optical. And the reason for that is our atmosphere is opaque to many wavelengths, but not to the optical. That's where light can go through the atmosphere. That's where our eyes are most sensitive to. But especially for the shorter wavelengths where we have higher energies, our atmosphere completely blocks out that light. There are also windows where light gets blocked here in the infrared range, but there is also a huge window where we can look through the atmosphere when it comes to radio waves. So when we do astronomy from the ground, we are limited to observing in one of these windows where we can look through the atmosphere. For all the other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum, we have to go into outer space. And we can do that for about 70 or 80 years now. So it's still a relatively new way of observing the universe. Now, so light as an experimental tool for us has some interesting properties. And one is that it subscribes to the particle wave duality principle. This was first postulated by Louis de Broglie, a French physicist, and later further developed by Erwin Schrödinger, a German physicist who's become famous for his work in quantum physics. And what that means is that light has the properties of both particles and waves. So we have the particle properties, which mean we have a finite amount of energy carried by light particles, or photons as we call them, and we also can subscribe wave properties, meaning we can assign a wavelength. That is what makes the color feature. So light has both properties, and only if we use both approaches to describe light, we can understand it correctly, as Einstein famously said. So now, what does it mean for us? So light is acting with, interacting with matter. When it does this, and we can use here, for example, an hydrogen atom, in the hydrogen atom, the one electron hydrogen has is orbiting the core in on a certain orbit. Now, if light interacts with that hydrogen atom, it can that hydrogen atom can absorb light if it has the right energy, and can end up in a higher state of energy, meaning that electron orbits the core on a different orbit. Now, that is very specific for each element in the universe. And we can see this in spectra. We can see when matter is absorbing light, like here is a spectrum, so-called Fraunhofer spectrum of the sun. And you see all these black lines here. This is where light gets absorbed by material in the sun. And where these black lines are is very specific for the element which absorbs the light. So by analyzing these spectra, we can figure out what the sun is made of. The other way around, once these atoms are excited, as we call this, they can also spontaneously re-emit that light and go back into lower states of energy. This emitted light we can see as emission lines, as shown here in the Balmer series of emission. So we have very distinct, very sharp lines, and these lines are according to which energy state the atom was and before it emitted that light. So here, for example, H alpha, we call that line is a relatively red line at 6563 angstrom. Angstrom is a unit used often by astronomers instead of nanometer. It's in principle 0.1 nanometer. So we have a very sharp line here. This is a transition going from the third orbit down to the second orbit. Here we have the H beta line going from the fourth to the second, and so on and so on. So we have these very sharp lines which tell us, if we analyze them right, which tell us what material has emitted that line. So now that, knowing that, we have now two approaches of how we can study the sky. The first we call imaging. What we do here is, in principle, projecting the sky two-dimensionally on the surface of a detector. And here, for example, we see a rendering of the future a camera within the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. The Large Synoptic Survey Telescope is an 8-meter telescope which will be in operation starting, I think, 2018. It has this huge camera, and if you see over here, that is called the filter unit. Just for comparison, there's a person standing. So that is how big that camera is, not comparable to the small cameras we all carry with us in our phones. However, the principle of how these produce images is pretty similar, and they use Einstein's photoelectric effect for it. So we use these cameras to get a two-dimensional projected image of the sky. Now, if we wouldn't put anything in between the light coming from the sky and the detector, we would get white light, and it's very difficult to figure out what is going on. So what we do, we use these filters. These filters cut out parts of the spectrum, very defined parts, like here, this blue curve represents the light which gets through to the detector in the blue wavelength regime. And we have many of these filters, and we take images in each of them and then combine them and get these beautiful color images out of them. The advantage of that method is we can observe many galaxies. This here is a simulated image how the LSST will see the sky. And within that image are tens of thousands of galaxies, which we can see with one observation. However, our spectral resolution, so the information about what these galaxies are made of, is very limited. Now, for this we have a second method we call spectroscopy. What we do there, in principle, is spread out the light very fine to get as detailed information as possible out of it. And we take a spectrum like here. This is a spectrum taken with the Hubble Space Telescope of a high redshift galaxy. And we see, again, these sharp emission lines here. That is what we can use to measure distances. We can analyze the composition of the object. However, the disadvantage of that method is that we only can observe one or very few objects at a time, because we have to use the space on our detectors to spread out the light and get the detailed information about the light. So the best multi-object spectrograph nowadays are maybe capable of doing a few hundred up to a thousand galaxies at a time. Also, since we spread out the light so far or very detailed, that reduces sensitivity because the light is not concentrated in one resolution element anymore of our detectors. It gets spread out over many resolution elements, and so we are limited to brighter sources. We cannot observe as deep as we would be able to observe with imaging. So, now that we can observe the sky, we can extract information. Let's talk a little bit about what we want to extract. And one of the important, if not the most important information we need is distances. So for us to be able to measure distances, we especially when we do extragalactic work, we need to have one information, and that is that the universe is expanding. That means that objects moving away from each other. So if we look out into the universe, most of all galaxies, except for those which are very local, move away from us. That has an effect that the light emitted by these galaxies gets redshifted. So similar to, imagine you have a car with a speaker on the roof and you drive away from someone. The pitch of the noise from the speaker gets lower the further you go away. This is what happens here with the light. And we can measure this. Here, for example, we have, again, on the left side, a spectrum of the sun with these sharp absorption lines. And we compare this to a spectrum with the same line, but this time from a cluster of galaxies at much greater distance. And we see how these lines get shifted into the red wavelength. So we can measure this shift, and from that shift, we can calculate a value we call the redshift, z. It in principle tells us how many times further away an object is. Now, adding a little bit more information, we know that there is a linear correlation between a physical distance, so something measured in meters, or in astronomy we use parsecs or megaparsecs, and the speed with which this object moves away from us. That was found by Edwin Hubble, and I will show a little bit more about this later. And it's called the Hubble's law. Here you see these linear relations as it is calibrated with or shown with using different sources going out to a distance up to about 400 megaparsecs. Adding in that velocity and redshift is correlated via the speed of light, we can use our redshift information and Hubble's law to calculate physical distances. However, that method needs to be calibrated. And for it to be calibrated, we use what we call the distance level. So we use different methods for different distances because they are sensitive to different distances. Here, in the for the closest stars, we can use a method called parallax. And what that is, in principle, we take pictures of an object twice a year, 6 months apart. That means they are on opposite sides of the sun when we take these pictures. And what happens is we see that object under a different angle, and it appears on the images like it would move around. And you can do this experiment with yourself. You can shut one, you focus on one point, shut one of the eyes, and shut the other, and you see how that object is moving around. So this works for relatively large angles, meaning the objects have to be very nearby to be able, because you have to be able to resolve this little wiggle. And that is good for about 10 10 power equals of power. Now, we can use this to determine the distances, very accurate distances for the closest stars, and then study these stars and better understand them, and use other methods to step along this ladder. And then there are a few which I want to point out, and the one which is important for extragalactic studies is using variable stars like R. Lyrae and Cepheid stars. Especially Cepheid stars, that method was developed by Henrietta Leavitt at Harvard Observatory. She found that the variation in the brightness of these stars is correlated with the period, with the time these stars need to change their brightness. And knowing this, the luminosity correlates with the time changed, they need to change it. So knowing this and not understanding how these stars exactly work, and that gives us an understanding of how bright they should be, we can, by observing how quickly they change the brightness, can go back and know how bright they are in reality, and then use that to calculate a distance out of it. And that method extends our ability to measure distances accurately very far out, at least a few megaparsecs. And for the really big distances, we use objects like supernovae, especially supernovae from the type 1a. Supernovae are stars which are exploding at the end of their life cycles. And surprisingly, these supernovae 1a have a very a similar behavior. So they have, from determining their peak brightness, we can go back and know how bright these objects are, and that in absolute brightness, and that allows us to calculate the distance. So using these different methods, we reach a point where we can use redshift as a measure for a distance. So much for the basics. Now let's look a little bit into the history of galaxies. So what are galaxies, and how we discovered them? First of all, galaxies come from the Greek word galaxia, means milky. These are organized systems of stars, gas, dust, and dark matter, and these parameters are bound gravitationally. So we categorize them in mainly two classes. We have elliptical galaxies, which are relatively featureless spheroids, and they sit in a dark matter halo. And the other class are disk galaxies, like our own Milky Way, where we have a center sphere, which we call the bulge, which usually consists of all stars, and we have a disk component, and that too resides in a dark matter halo. Here we have two examples for these objects: the pinwheel galaxy, nicely shows its spiral arms here, and shows these blue areas in the outer skirt. So a lot of structure in here, while the elliptical galaxies are relatively featureless, very smooth light distribution. So how did we discover that galaxies actually exist? And the first mention of these nebulous objects has been actually in the 10th century by a Persian astronomer called Al-Sufi. He wrote a book called Book of Fixed Stars, and he mentioned that in the constellation Andromeda there is this nebulous object, and what he referred to is the Andromeda galaxy, and it should actually reside right here. This is a constellation of stars in the Andromeda constellation. He reported in his book, and I think if I got it right, it should reside right here. So that was the first mention of these nebulous objects on the sky. And he will, since he, in the 10th century, the telescope didn't exist yet, he observed this with a naked eye. Now, nowadays, it's most definitely almost impossible in most areas to observe deep sky objects with the naked eye because you have so much light pollution. But if you ever have the chance to get out, maybe in the southwest or somewhere in a remote area where we have really nice and dark sky, you should definitely do it. It's an amazing feeling to stand under these millions of stars. Okay, the term Milky Way actually was crafted by Geoffrey Chaucer. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. It's a 13th century English poet, philosopher, and astronomer. And he mentioned the term first in one of his poems. Later then, in the late 18th century, that was the time when research into these objects really started, and Thomas Wright was one of the first to speculate that actually these nebulous objects are comparable to our Milky Way, and they are distant and not belong to our Milky Way. Immanuel Kant, a German philosopher and astronomer, later used the term island universe for this. Now, island universe is maybe a little bit misleading, because universe usually means that it includes everything. So, but for given the time, he phrases the term. It's actually pretty amazing to come to this understanding. Then later in the 18th and beginning 19th century, we had our first big catalog of these objects created. Charles Messier, for example, is one name to mention, who cataloged over 100 bright objects on the sky, and we still use his catalog numbers to give galaxies names. So if you ever see a galaxy with an M in front of it for Messier, that is one of the objects he observed. Then later, William Herschel started to catalog the sky. His work was finished later by his son, John Herschel, and they together came up with a catalog of over 5,000 objects. And most of the observations were actually done with this little 6-inch reflector here. Herschel's best-liked instrument. He had a couple of others. He was also very into building telescopes, grinding his own mirrors, but this was his favorite. And this is a replica of it. I think it's in somewhere in a museum in London, if I'm not mistaken. The work of Herschel was the basis for a famous catalog we still use today, that's the NGC catalog, or New General Catalog, that was redone and expanded and made better by John Dreyer. And then in the mid-19th century, Lord Rose, using the Leviton 70-inch, at the time the biggest telescope in the world, with a 6-foot focal length, to observe the sky and observe these nebula. And he was the first one to actually discover spiral structure in M51. And here is his drawing. Back at the day, they still had to draw what they see because they didn't have any photographic plates or electronic detectors as we have them today. He even was able to capture the companion of M51, NGC 5195. So, very active time, and at the beginning of the 20th century, people came to the point that they really asked the question, what are these nebula actually? And it came down to two, let's say, schools. Hollow Sharpley is one of them, represents the school who thought that these objects are within our Milky Way, while Herbert Curtis represented the other school, which said that these objects definitely are outside of our own Milky Way. And the whole discussion came down to what we call today the Great Debate in Washington on April 26, 1920. Now, at the time, it was actually not set up as a big debate. They only wanted to have a scientific discussion, so each of them gave a talk. and presented their arguments, and it was not in a debate in the sense we know debate today, where people shout at each other. And it was a very civil time back then. And you can read actually what they presented, they put into a paper later on, and that was published by the National Research Council. You can read that online, it's available via archives.org, and it's actually a really nice read. So, what they did, they discussed recent results on things like global star clusters, how they are distributed, how to measure distances, for example, the Cepheid, using Cepheid stars for this, a very new method at the time. Theory of stellar evolution, that was still in its infancy. People started to get an understanding of how stars evolve, how they are made, and then how they get to where we observe them. Also, the phenomena of novae, which later, at the time, only were accounted as novae, but after understanding the distances in the universe, were subdivided into supernovae, much brighter objects, and into novae. And they also discussed the properties of these spiral nebulae and came up with their own conclusions to each of them. And as I said, sharply on the side of these objects being in the Milky Way, argued that the presented results leave him no alternative to think that the galactic system, meaning the Milky Way, is at least 10 times greater than people have expected so far. And for him, that is opposed to the idea that these spiral nebula are galaxies outside our own galaxy. On the other side, Curtis argued that for him, there is no doubt that, especially his main argument is around the distribution of many of the object classes observed, like star clusters, many of the stars and so on, that they all have higher densities once you go closer to the disk of the Milky Way. Except for the spiral nebula, that was for him his main argument, that all these stars belong to the Milky Way except the spiral nebula. They, in his mind, could only be distant galaxies similar to our own Milky Way, but much, much more distant. Both scientists actually had good points on their side, but they also made mistakes. So, for example, Curtis rejected the method of using Cepheid to accurately measure the distance. And that's a big mistake, because that will be the method which actually proves this claim a few years later. While Chatelet vastly overestimated the order, maybe not vastly in astronomical terms, but he overestimated the size of the Milky Way. His preferred number was about 300,000 light years. We now know that the Milky Way is about 100 to 180,000 light years. So, a few years after this great debate, Edwin Hubble did lots of his work. Edwin Hubble, who at some time actually lived here in Louisville. And there are still, I think, Jerry, two or three houses where he lived in. Three houses are still around.
We built two right here, one's about three quarters of a mile.
And he, at that time, he actually took a break from science and university education. He worked at New Albany High School as a basketball coach.
And math teacher.
And math teacher, yeah. More impressive if he is a basketball coach. So he did quite extensive work on studying these spiral nebula. And in 1923, he finally could prove that Andromeda was not residing within our own galaxy, but was outside. And the way he did it is actually the same method Curtis rejected in the Great Debate. He used the Cepheid variable, and here is the original plate of the discovery of that variable in Andromeda. Here you see that red box, that's with Hubble's handwriting. He had before an N for new discovery, And then he crossed that out and wrote var for variable with an exclamation point. So that was the discovery of a specified variable which could be used to determine the distance of Andromeda. And it shows definitely that Andromeda is not in our own Milky Way. So later on, he and his colleague Johansson, they used with their observation also, and that's what made Hubble actually most famous, found the or discovered that the universe is expanding. They measured the rate of this expansion and came up with the first size estimate for the universe. Again, he used his observation of 46 nearby galaxies. He used to come up with this correlation between the physical distance and the speed with which these galaxies move away from us. And this correlation parameter H0 here, we call it the Hubble constant. At his time, from his as well, the Hubble constant was estimated to be 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Much too high. So now, today we know it's more around 68 kilometers per second per megaparsec, but it is explainable because he had some mistakes in how he came up with the distance for Andromeda, so that's why his number was wrong. Another very famous work of his was coming up with the classification system for galaxies. And he very extensively observed these spiral nebulas and realized they are not all the same. They look different, and I can put them into classes. The astronomers love classes. We love drawers that we can put stuff in, because that means stuff in that drawer has similar properties, and we can handle that easier. So he came up with a system of how to classify these galaxies, which we still call today the Hubble classification. It has to become much more complex with the increase of knowledge about these galaxies, but at his time it was an amazing system, and we often display this classification system here in what we call the Hubble tuning form. And then in here you see these objects on the left side, which are called early type galaxies. They are very featureless, very smooth, often a very bright center. These are the elliptical galaxies. And the further we go to the left, the more structure we get. Here we arrive at the lenticle galaxies. They almost look like little lenses. And then we subdivide our class into two branches. One where we see clear indication for a bar in the center, and the others without the bar. And then we go from SA all the way to irregular galaxies. And here, how tightly the spiral arms are winded around the center determines if you have earlier type SA or maybe a more late type SC galaxy. The irregular galaxies here in this little thumbnail, that's the Large Magellanic Cloud, our closest neighboring galaxy, the dwarf galaxy. They have very, as the name says, irregular structure, so we don't see this fine spiral type or spherical structures. Here are a few more examples which really nicely show how structureless these elliptical galaxies really are. And the further we go along these classification, we see more and more structure coming in. Here, for example, that's M102. It has this nice band of depth dust where the disk is located, and this very spherical, smooth distribution of light around it. Here we have an SBC galaxy. We also do these classifications where you not jump from B to C, but it's something in between. And you see how tightly the spiral arms are here wrapped around. But if you look at M101, for example, here we have this nice, loose spiral So that's enough about history, and let's talk about the key questions we want to answer, and especially the key questions we concentrate on here in our project. And that is, how did galaxies get to the, their present varieties of form? As I mentioned before, we basically subdivide in two big classes, large ellipticals, which have old stars, which give them a red color, and relatively little gas in them, and spiral galaxies, which have very young stars and have a lot of gas, a lot of fuel produce new gas, new stars. But if you look throughout the universe, and here's a nice scheme which visualizes that. Here's a timeline, and here's in principle a different types of galaxies. And if you go back in time and look around, you see the galaxies are even within this classes are not equal. There's a wide variety of them. You have big disk galaxies. You have compact objects, especially in the early beginning of the universe. So the question is, how did these galaxies get to their present form, variety of form? Now, to answer that question, we can approach this with two different ways. First of all, we could use our Milky Way as an example and study this very extensively, or we can go out and study huge samples of galaxies, but then study them over a wide redshift range, meaning a wide range in time at different phases of their evolution. Now, using the Milky Way is a more indirect way of studying evolution of galaxies, because what we are doing is we're taking, so to say, a snapshot of its current state. This is when we observe it, and then we go into detail. We look at the stars in our Milky Way, and we can do this actually for a few galaxies, other galaxies too, but they have to be very close, so we are able to resolve these galaxies into their single components. So we start looking in at the stars. We look how the stars evolve, how they work. Then we look at the interstellar medium and look on the composition and how how the interstellar medium gets fueled with heavier elements. We can look at different components of the galaxies, like shown here in this diagram. This studies stars within different parts: the inner disk, so that's the blue dots here, and the inner thin disk. So the galaxy has in principle, two disk components, one thin disk, which resides in a thicker disk. And then we have here, the orange ones are the thick disk. And what is plotted is actually the amount of heavier elements in these stars, and that compared to the age of these stars. And we see that there's a clear difference between stars within the inner disk, thin disk, and stars which are in the thick disk. The thick disk is much older and has a lower amount of heavier elements, and that's understandable. Heavier elements are produced in supernovae, so you need stars to actually produce these heavier elements and give these heavier elements back to the interstellar medium, where you form new stars. So the more often you form stars, the more of those heavier elements you put into your material to form new stars, and your stars become has a higher content of these heavier elements. So these stars being old, being formed relatively early with little heavy elements in the interstellar medium, means they appear here in the diagram, while the young stars, which are formed comparatively recent, they have a much higher content. Now, this is a very detailed study, and we can use many wavelength ranges, go from the highest energies, gamma ray down here, all the way to radio. Here we have our own Milky Way in the optical light. You see nicely the dust planes. Then if you go to the infrared, for example, where dust doesn't play a role anymore, you see a lot of the older stars, which are very bright in the infrared. So we can do this, but there's one problem with this approach. This we can only do for the Milky Way and a few others. And the question is, are these objects maybe special? They all reside in a similar environment, and environment plays a role for the evolution of the galaxies, so we don't know exactly if these are similar. So we can use a different approach, And that's in situ, meaning we observe many objects at many different times, and then we derive average parameter of these objects at these times and try to describe the evolution that way. Here, for example, we have this diagram shows 300 galaxies in the Cosmos field, which is a relatively large field observed at the northern sky, observed by the infrared satellite Herschel. And it tells us a lot about the evolution of these galaxies, but we have to derive average parameters for these classes. So now the question here is, or the problem is, we only have or get statistical parameters, average parameters. Question is, how well do these average results describe a very specific object in all time? So you have pros and cons on both sides. This can only be done for a very limited number of objects. This can be done for lots of objects, but gives only a more limited view on what happens. So, now, nonetheless, if you study the high redshift universe, you have no other choice than using large samples of galaxies. And here is an image of the very famous Hubble Ultra Deep Field. It's one of the deepest observations on the sky, done with a wide array of filter bands with the Hubble Space Telescope. So it gives us the best spatial resolution on the sky. And if you look, each of these points in here is a galaxy. And we have no, just by looking on them, we cannot tell where they are and what they are. So we and it's almost impossible. Here also you see nicely the variety of objects you find in these images. But it's almost impossible to go and get spectra which would give us much more detailed information about them to each object. So we have to cut down on classes of galaxies which we are interested in to answer our question. And that is what we do before we go and do spectroscopic observations. We select objects and we try to use properties of these objects which tell us already a little bit about where they are. For example, we can select so-called extremely red objects. These are very very dusty starbursts, meaning they produce a lot of stars in one moment, and the dust is reddening these objects. we could another subclass of these EROs are also passively evolving. That means these galaxies do not form new stars anymore. They just sit there and these stars age. That's why they get red. Another way would be to look for what we call distant red galaxies, very massive galaxies with 10 to the 11 to 10 to the 12 solar masses in stars, also starburst galaxies. They have high star formation rates with 100 solar masses per year. In comparison, our own galaxy only produces a few stars per year. Submillimeter galaxies, another class, and then prime and alpha absorbers, which can be identified by the absorption of ultraviolet light. And what we use to select these galaxies are these diagrams over here, so called color magnitudes or color diagrams. That's where a color for an object in astronomy is the difference between the flux in two different filter bands. By definition, it's always the bluer filter band minus the red filter band. And that gives us an idea of what these, a basic idea of what these objects are made of. And they different classes of objects have different locations in these diagrams, and that can be what we can use to pre-select them, and we can measure these magnitudes and colors from images by measuring the flux of these objects. So a very nice way of cutting down on the objects. But the most successful method to actually select high redshift galaxies is the so-called Lyman break method. It selects galaxies which show a break in the spectrum. Here we see the wavelength versus an arbitrary flux, and you see how the spectrum of this object here breaks down at what would be a laboratory wavelength of 912 angstrom. And this high flux here that comes due to strong star formation in these galaxies. So they produce a lot of ultraviolet light. This 912 angstrom is far into the ultraviolet light. And then we have within the galaxies, we have a lot of gas and dust. And also between the galaxy and us as observer, there's also a lot of gas. This gas absorbs these UV photons. So everything which has more energy energy which is relates to wavelength than the 912 angstrom photon. So everything which is left here gets absorbed on the way from the galaxy to us, and we see this break. And that can be used to select these clusters like galaxy. And by knowing where that is, we actually can make a first estimation of the distance. And the technique we use for this is the so-called dropout technique. Here you see one of the examples from one of our work. This object here is observed in many different filter bands. You see them comparable set of filters listed here. And we cut out little sections out of the spectrum, and that gives us some information about it. But if we look here in the ultraviolet range, which is observed by a satellite called Galax, we see that object is not there. And it should be there if it is not at a certain redshift. But here in the U-band, which can be observed from the ground, all of a sudden that object pops up. So that's what we call a dropout technique. And we can use these images to search for those objects which are within in a red filter band, but not in a blue filter band. And this method is actually ideal for targeting the highest redshift galaxies. Here we see examples for galaxies which have been discovered at redshift greater than 9. That means the universe was just a few hundred million years old. And you see here that is a composite of all optical wavelengths. And then you go in the near-infrared and in the mid-infrared regime. And here we go from a redshift around 9. Here we have a redshift 10 sample. That's almost 11. You see how this object pops out here in this near-infrared filter band. And all of a sudden, that moves further to the next one. So the higher it's redshifted, the further into the red that detection filter moves. So very elegant method to detect these objects. The record holder today is a galaxy at a redshift of 11.9, detected by a group around Richard Ellis. And that is at an age about 400 million years after the Big Bang. Here down we see plotted the very low resolution spectrum, so the flux from these images versus the wavelength, the central wavelength of the filter used, and then it is compared to theoretical spectra of a galaxy, and it nicely shows the break and gives a high probability that is shown here that this object resides at a redshift of 11.9. Now, hunting for the highest redshift object is not just nice to have it, it immediately gives us information about the evolution of the universe. If I go back to this picture from the beginning, because what it does, it pushes the limits for this transition here. From the dark ages, where the universe was completely neutral, to where the first stars have formed and started to emit light. We still don't know exactly where that is. So with every galaxy we can detect at a greater distance, we know that limit is pushed further back in time. So we are right now are at about 400 million years. But who knows, maybe in a year or two we go even closer to the beginning. So the first sliver of information out. So what do we know about these high redshift galaxies? At redshift greater than 9, this is where we have the most distant star formation going on, and it's where we think the epoch of what we call reionization. So the first stars are formed due to density fluctuations, so the medium is not smooth. You have these little pockets of higher density, which all of a sudden attract more matter, and the material starts to gravitate towards those denser areas and start to become clouds and collapse into stars. That's what emits light and starts to reionize the universe, and that's what we call the epoch of reionization. Then we go a little bit closer to home, redshifts of 5 to 6, that we have very young objects there, about 100 million years old. Masses are relatively low, only 10 to the 9 solar masses. They make about 1% of the local mass density, so it's about 1% in these galaxies. They are very compact galaxies with a relatively high star formation rate of 40 solar masses per year. At a redshift of 3, that's when the universe is about 2 to 3 billion years old. These objects have grown in size. They are 10 times more massive. They host a large part of the star formation, and they also consist of a subclass of objects which are very dusty. So we have a lot of dust in these objects. These dusty objects, they also contribute significantly to the global star formation going on in this example. Then that is a redshift range of interest to us. We have a very complex mix of populations, red and blue objects. The alignment break to identify these objects, and that is a problem, it's shifted into the observable UV. So we cannot find these objects with data we take from the ground. We have to go into outer space of doing this, and that has only been possible for about 10, 15 years. And finally, the redshift of 1, these objects have become more red. We have significant star formation in these red subpopulations. Most of the galaxies, the Lyman Break galaxies there, are dominated by disks, and only a few have these spheroidal shapes. We have significant activity between the galaxies, so galaxies tend to merge in each other, and a small fraction of the star formation rate is only contributed by them. So, as I mentioned, we are mainly, with our work, interested in this redshift regime, and the reason for our interest is shown on this. This is what we call a key era. What we know about this era is right around here, between 1 and 3, is where the star formation rate peaks in the universe. That is when most of the stars are formed. Before, it slowly increases, and right after redshift of 1, there's a steep drop in the formation of new stars. So the question is why, and how does this affect the evolution? We also know that in that time is about when these galaxies undergo massive transformation. The disks in these galaxies are formed, and the bulges, so the central spheroidal parts, grow significantly. So for us, a very interesting period, and what we actually want to look at is how these disks, how these bulges and so on, how they form. And how, here for example, we have work done here in the Milky Way. It shows the look-back time versus the star formation rate for parts of the thin disk and the thick disk. And we see that there was an increase in star formation activity about 10 billion years back in time. That is what it's about the time the thick disk was formed. So that was about the time when the universe was 2 billion to 3 billion years old. And then later we have another slightly increase here around 3 to 6 billion years back in time. That is when the thin disk formed. So by looking at different galaxies at these times, we can actually observe how these disks, or we hope we can observe how these disks are formed. So star forming galaxies, very interesting topic. Again, the illustration of how we detect them in the images, especially for the UV, we need observation from space done with satellites to detect this drop here in flux and then have them observed with many other filter bands. We did one of those studies 2 years back where we used data for a very public field called the Goods Field, and where we used the dropout technique to search for these star-forming galaxies. Then we used these color selection methods to select our samples and came up with a certain color criterion. We were able to discover about 67 objects in this field after we cleaned our catalog for stellar objects, which can be often a hassle because they are point light, and or at those redshifts when you use especially ground-based data, all the objects are point light, so you cannot quite disangle between galaxy and a star. So you need to use a few criteria like brightness and accurate measure of the shape, and then you can reject those stellar contamination. So as I said, 67 objects we were able to identify. And the next step, what we had to do to get an idea of the distance, we measured what we call photometric redshift. And to get a photometric redshift, let's look at this diagram here, where we have a model spectra of two different galaxies at two different redshifts. And you see how the flux in a particular filter band changes from type to type and also with redshift. And knowing this, we can use this to estimate how far these objects are away. This is all done nowadays with computers. Here, for example, is the result for our work at the Goods South field. We calibrate this method by comparing our photometric redshifts we estimated to a set of known spectroscopic redshifts. Spectroscopic redshifts like here in this diagram, where we have very sharp emission lines which allow us to very accurately measure the distance of these objects. For a subset, we have that for our object 2, and that allows us to judge how well we can determine with these photometric measurements our distance. And as these diagrams show, this method works pretty well. There's only a slight offset in this distribution here, and the RMS is pretty small, and the percentage of outliers for our line array galaxies is only about 5%. So that is within acceptable limit, and we can use this method. The next step is to study what these galaxies are actually composed of and how these galaxies evolve. And what we do to get this information is we use what we call the spectral energy distribution, so the measurements in these different filter bands along the wavelength, and compare it to model spectra. There are models like the Pigalle model, developed by a French group in Paris, which produce these vast libraries of thousands and thousands of model spectra. We can run them here and then create our own libraries of models, and we into these models we put certain information in. So this is, don't get scared, it's how the equations work, but what we put in principle is, for example, the star formation rate. We fix and say, okay, that for that model we only want stars to be formed either in an instantaneous burst, so all stars at one point, or we want to have a constant star formation rate, so over the all time the same amount of stars get formed, or a decreasing star formation rate. Another information we put in is how many stars of a certain mass get formed. That's called the initial mass function. It describes how many very massive and how many low mass stars we want to have in our galaxy. And combine that with the flux of each of those stars, we can use this approach here to actually come up with a model spectrum for a galaxy. And here is one of those examples, an object from our sample for which we observed the flux. That's one of the input variables. And we determine the photometric redshift, that's another, because we need to know where this template here has to be in with respect to the wavelength. And running it through a fitting algorithm, we get all these information out. So we get an estimate for a mass, we get a very crude and often having the largest error estimate for the ages, that's one of the most difficult parameters to actually nail down. We get a good idea of what the star formation rates are, and we what how much of the light is actually absorbed by dust in these galaxies. And put this all together, that gives us the star formation history of a galaxy. Now we do this for large samples, and statistically seen over large samples, we are at a good shape. We have a good idea of how these galaxies evolve. As I said, all this work is done on computers, and here is the heart of our current computational resources within our group. My students use this very extensively, and they also contributed a lot to the talk by producing many of the diagrams. We have right now 32-core, 64-gigabyte RAM, and 32-terabyte disk space available. The field, as I mentioned, we observed was the good field, or good stands for Great Observatory Origin Deep Survey, and they observed actually two fields, one in the south, one in the north, and it's one of the best observed fields in on the sky. It has observation from almost all wavelength range, from the high energy X-ray all the way to the low energy radio. And using all these data, we were able to derive these spectral energy distributions for our objects, and this is what we got out of our studies. We saw that the vast majority of our objects actually have constant star formation rates, maybe a slightly decreasing star formation rate. There's a significant amount of reddening due to dust in these objects. When we compare this to other studies with other galaxies, we see that we have actually a very moderate sample of objects. The ages range between 4 million and 3 billion years. With some uncertainty, you see the error bars here for the ages. They are very large, so I would not give too much about the ages. However, the stellar masses between 10 to the 8 and 10 to the 10 means we have relatively moderate mass objects, not super heavy. Star formation rates are in the order of 50 solar masses per year, also for strongly star forming galaxies right within the pack. Here again, we see the distribution of ages. The masses compared to other objects selected the same redshift actually here in this bin. So we see our selection method favors objects which are more moderate in mass and are more comparable to actually higher redshift type objects over here. The star formation rate, same situation. We are more comparable to higher redshifted objects, but this time we have higher redshifts than objects selected at the same redshift with a different method. As subsamples of our objects are actually very luminous in the infrared regime, and for these objects we found that they are actually have higher masses and higher star formation rates and higher what we call extinction, which is a measure of how much light gets absorbed due to dust. let's skip over this slide. We did also some morphological, very crude morphological studies, meaning we looked how are the galaxies shaped, and we see that the majority of them are actually have disk features, and only a few have are very compact. Further studies looked into the dust, and that is actually some a project done by one of my master students, who is now one of the best places to study astronomy in Germany at the Leibniz Institute in Potsdam for doing her PhD there. She used far infrared data observed with Herschel. Again, here's the observation of Herschel overlaid to the Gould field. We were able to detect few of our objects, which are shown here, in these far infrared wavelength bands, and that's where dust has a peak of its emission. So by looking in these infrared wavelength bands, we can look and determine how much dust is in these galaxies. And we can do this by measuring the flux, plotting it against the wavelength, and then compare it to a model, a black body model, meaning that is a model for an object that is an ideal emitter and absorber. And this, in this model, the flux directly relates to the temperature. So by fitting this, we get an idea about the temperature, but we also get an idea about the mass. And using a simple black body model as approach, we found dust temperatures between 19 and 68 Kelvin. Remember, the absolute zero point is in Kelvin. So it's slightly above the absolute zero point. I think, let me see, 10 Kelvin is about minus 450 Fahrenheit or something in that direction. Always have difficulties converting. However, so very cold area, and that is where the new stars are actually formed, in these cold clouds of gas and dust. And the dust masses are relatively moderate, a few times 10 to the 8 solar masses of dust. Here, the same approach, this time this is a more complex model, where we use two different black body models, and the results are pretty similar, so we are pretty sure about those results. We find from these results, we also can estimate a total infrared luminosity. We find that these infrared luminosities are relatively moderate. They are not luminous infrared galaxies or ultra-luminous infrared galaxies. They more represent the normal galaxy. Further, we compare our dust masses to stellar masses, and we compare it with other samples, and we see that some of our objects fall right within the parameter space from the other surveys, but some of them are more have higher dust masses than expected. They are more comparable to what you would expect for the submillimeter galaxies, for example, at redshifts of 5 and 6. So that's a very interesting result. Here we are looking for the star formation rate. So when stars are formed in these dusty clouds of gas, then the UV emission of these young stars, it gets absorbed by the dust, but it gets also re-emitted in the infrared by the dust. And so we can use the infrared flux to actually give a good estimate of the actual star formation rate, because if you only use UV as a measure, you often underestimate your star formation rate. So by doing this, we came up with a much more accurate measure of our star formation rate. We could also, by adding both together, give a total star formation rate. And again, we are relatively moderate with the star formation rates in the order of 10 to 20 solar masses per year. So here's a summary of our results from that project. So we were able to detect about 5 of our sample galaxies within the infrared, so that means a good percentage is, has a good amount of dust in them. We derived dust parameters like temperatures, masses, and infrared luminosity. And we observed that trends reported by others, which tell us that the infrared emission of Langmuir ray galaxies changes between the redshifts of 3 and 1, that is something we see too. Now, just 1 minute, I think, quickly, future projects. Here we want to look further into the dust properties of galaxies, because right now we have done this in a very tiny area in the sky. We want to extend this to a much larger field using existing data, and we started a survey which we call the Galileo survey, which is actually the word for this little shark over here, which stands for Galaxy Evolution UV Survey, and the goal of this is to study objects which are specifically selected in observed UV data. And we want to study large-scale structures and how these objects evolve. And one project very near and dear to my heart is the project of my PhD student, Matt Nichols, and he is looking into how these disks in galaxies evolve. So he will use high-resolution imaging from the Hubble Space Telescope and create these difference maps in flux. So we have a blue filter over here, we have a red filter over here. If we subtract the red from the blue, we get this image. We get a color image. And that tells us how the color evolves along the galaxy. So if we, for example, would have a younger disk, an outer disk, we would see a bluer outer disk. And that is what we are looking for in these images. Now there are a few complications we have to always take into account. Dust can redden or change our color. That's something we have to overcome, but very optimistic this project will bring interesting results. And again, this goes all back to understanding how these galaxies evolve, how they change, or they go through the transition phase at redshift 3 to 1, and gives us an idea how our own Milky Way maybe becomes the galaxy we see today. So we think the future looks very exciting, and I thank you for your attention, and apologize that I went over time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lewis. I'd like to make this really, really, really informal. I invite you to talk a lot. There's no refreshments tonight because we have no budget. But I'd like you to feel free to come down. We have a sign-up sheet here if you'd like to get on an email list for future events. We're going to have another talk on December 3rd, and we're going to have some next spring. And then we also have a little donation container here. If you're a student here, no. But if you are, if you have some sort of income and you can give us pin money, a couple bucks, $5, something like that, this will go for stronger research and support students like these. So, any questions for Lewis? Feel free, including like what have the students been doing and talk to them.
I have a question.
Yes.
Do the quantons have a role in those galaxies?
Oh, they most certainly have. I have quasars also because they are very specific type of galaxy. So quasar itself is the very energetic center of the galaxy where the black hole resides, and the axis black hole projects vast amount of material with high energy. And that it can be seen, it's very luminous, and that can be seen for far distances. So they are very special within how they evolve and how they influence the intergalactic medium. They have definitely some influence of how other galaxies evolve too. So I left them out a little bit, but yeah. Jerry is also the person to talk to. He's an expert on
the
radio.
And Dr. LaRose as well. Dr. LaRose.
Yeah.
So we have quite a bit of that.
So I want to be tuning for the organization of the
Yeah, that is.
am I looking at that in the right way?
No, exactly. It is not. This classification scheme is not meant to be seen as an evolutionary scale.
Okay.
Like, historically, we call these galaxies early type and late type, but with no means is there an age associated with it. Now, you can say that the late type usually show younger stellar population mixes because they have these ongoing stars.
the mixture of stars within the galaxy are much more complex. So you can, for example, not say that the late type, which appears to be young, has no orthospots. That's not true. They have orthospots. But the light is mainly dominated from the younger stars, because they are so much brighter. So it would be very difficult to actually associate the accurate evolution scale with the tuning fork. It's more, you have to see the classification more in the sense of, okay, I put objects together in a box which seem similar, so they have to have similar mechanisms going on to get where they are, or might be in the same stage of.
So when you start here and end up here, but more of a.
It's not that easy. There is some resemblance. There is some resemblance to that, so you definitely, at some point, you need a galaxy which strongly forms stars to produce one of the big elliptical systems. Now, but it's not an automatic mechanism going from the left side to the right side. That's actually the misnomer here is early type and late type. If you really want to associate something in some age with it, the early types are actually the older ones, while the late types are the younger ones. But people looked at these galaxies and thought, okay, they have almost no structure, so they must be still getting to the point where they have these structures like the other ones. But it's the other way around. No, no. We don't see 13.8. We see maybe a little bit less. Always keep in mind, at some point, the first signal we see is the microwave background. Now that is that fractions of a second after the Big Bang, but we do not see all the way to the Big Bang.
So it's literally just a fraction of a second.
Yeah. Yes, you can only see to the finite, but it does. But from what we know about the universe, you know it's infinite. I have to go into more details about that. It can take a whole night. But
so, is the farthest object you can see less than about 13 billion
light
years?
In terms of galaxies. In terms of galaxies, yes. The earliest galaxy we currently see is that object I showed at a redshift of 11.9, which means it's about 400,000 years after the Big Bang.
So the expansion doesn't make it any further away?
No, including the expansion of the universe. That is, as I mentioned, that galaxy right now, holding the record, means that is when the first stars were born, 400,000 years after the Big Bang. Before the universe was neutral, we now know that at least 400,000 years after the Big Bang, the first generation of stars has formed. We might even push that limit further back to the Big Bang, maybe 300,000, that depends on how far out we can detect more galaxies. Right now, it's 400,000. And these numbers of 400,000 and so on, they always depend on what type of cosmology you use. So redshift is actually a much better measure because it's independent.
I'd like to invite you to come down and ask more questions as opposed to individually. So I also have some goodies for you. Posters to advertise. If you are off campus or even on, put them off when we're trying to get the word out. We don't have the advertising budget for Google lectures, so if you could just take a few of these, we'd appreciate it. And any donations are tax deductible.
thank you for coming out and staying so late. Jerry, do you usually shut down the projector, or I don't want to have them run the whole night. Can we put them?
Go ahead.
Hi. I hope I didn't bore you guys.
No, you confused me.
Let
did
me
not
set.
Warn
I should check it out. Hmm? Oh. No.
I think I'm going to start referring to all my wavelength stuff in angstroms now instead of nanometers. I think I'll be.
Yeah, it's an old astronomer problem. We always have to make up our own units, but it's because we have to bridge such a large scale from the tiniest to the largest. Yeah, thank you very much for coming out. That was highly appreciated. I hope I did not bore you guys.
I was actually here half an hour early. Because I had it in my calendar at 7, which was nice too, because we just kind of walked around campus a little bit. It was nice.
Is this
yours?
Yeah, kind of. I can set it up. Yeah. I take it off. Exists and starts to expand, or everything is moving away from each other.
Okay, well,